It is this, that a certain amount of the material that makes his astral body is not available while he is connected with his physical body, for it goes to make the vital cord or connection between his traveling spirit and his stationary body, which is only severed at death, for this severing means death. After this has occurred, of course, no cord being then required, this material is available for his astral body, and so he no longer requires to borrow astral atoms to protect himself. His spirit is sufficiently clothed, being complete. As I am not in the astral, I find it difficult to tell if a person is in their permanent astral body or not. This accounts too for the difficulty a clairvoyant sometimes has in being able to say if a person is in or out of their physical body permanently. They too are, it must be remembered, seeing in other conditions than their normal. Sight varies enough. Even on the earth plane, no two men there see exactly alike. If you took a collection of people to a hilltop and asked them to describe the view without artificial aid, they would all see in different degrees, some only things near, others only things distant, some as it were through a haze, and others clearly. This is why normal clairvoyance is often incorrect. Things are difficult to see in the right perspective, and it varies too according to the bias of the medium's brain on which it is registered by the sight. A thought form is a picture, a thought photograph, projected through the atmosphere by someone, but the recipient would have to mentally develop it, as it were, in order to see it. By that I mean they would have to be thinking of the sender at the right moment, and in the right way. Space is nothing, for it takes no longer to think 400 or 500 miles than into the next room. So if you are in the right mental condition, you can see a thought form, it's only a picture in the atmosphere. This explains certain things, for instance, visions of Christ to the dying. Hundreds on the battlefields may see him individually and spontaneously. If he is projecting his thought to all who are lying there, all who are attuned in mind can and may be able to see him. Just as when a ship at sea sends out a wireless message or a call for help, it is not confined to one receiver, but is open to all ships and receiving stations which are suitably attuned. So all who are suitably attuned and harmonized can receive thought pictures, impressions, and inspiration. This explains also how various people in widely separated places may simultaneously be inspired by one individual. Inspired, I said, not controlled, remember. Mum, that is a very different matter. People should always use common sense in judging what they are told. Personally, I don't believe spirits from the higher spheres ever control people on Earth. It is hard enough for us who are only on a third sphere to get back into the old conditions. For those it would be exceedingly difficult and a deliberate waste. It would be like engaging a tutor of the highest scholastic attainments to teach an infant its ABC. Now, as regards a so-called ghost haunting a particular spot. If it is a persistent haunt that has continued for many years, even for centuries, it is almost certainly a thought form and not a spirit, for it is very unlikely that any spirit would be so unfriended as to be permitted to go on in this aimless and unhappy manner indefinitely, for as soon as anyone desires help here it is forthcoming. What happens is this. Certain events, probably tragic, which are felt very intensely by the participators at the time, leave a very clear-cut and well-defined picture in the atmosphere, and at first for a short time the actors in the scene may return in spirit to the spot, and by thinking over what happened revivify and intensify that thought picture. Ordinary people then come to that place knowing its history, and some may see the ghost, and they see it because they are psychic and unconsciously psychometrize the atmosphere, and so mentally develop the picture that is there, and so constantly renew the image, which thus becomes almost permanent. Yes, I know it does seem difficult to realize, but it also applies to feeling as well as seeing past conditions. Thus a medium feels pain and discomfort when describing the illness of anyone. The medium is psychometrizing the condition connected with the spirit while it was a body, and not the spirit itself. I say this because I have been told and have noticed myself that spirits are surprised on returning to Earth to hear themselves described with symptoms of disease they have almost forgotten they ever suffered. For instance, your father, who died over 35 years ago, here is in perfect health, Yet whenever he returns to Earth, the mediums describe him as having a cough and discomfort in his chest. That was true when he passed over. He died of pneumonia, but of course is totally unlike his present condition. Another man I know, who had some very painful disease which affected one leg, tells me he gets quite angry when he hears it described now, as he no longer feels it at all even when he returns to Earth conditions, and yet the mediums describe it most accurately, and one might imagine he was still in suffering instead of in perfect health. Religion and science, thought, and thoughts. It is curious that modern investigations have reconciled religion and science, for there was a time when religious teachers feared the revelations of scientists, but as a matter of fact these taught better than they knew, for further knowledge has strengthened faith and not undermined it. Truth will always bear the light. Many in the past who disbelieved Bible statements now realize it was possible for these seeming miracles to have really happened. They know that the appearance of Christ after his resurrection, in a locked and barred up room, was a possible fact, for he was in his spirit body, and thousands of men revisit the earth in this way daily now, though only those who are psychically developed can see them. It is possible for spirit bodies to go through apparently solid substances, just as sunlight goes through glass, or heat through metal, for as a matter of fact no atoms of matter are actually touching, however solid they may appear to be. Man is a triune being, and consists of body, soul, and spirit, though in the world we live as if we consisted of a material body only, with a small spirit tucked away somewhere as a kind of afterthought. Through his ill-balanced development, man does not half realize his own possibilities. I want to impress upon you, apropos of this, the enormous importance of thought. If men only realized and cultivated their powers in this direction, they might do wonderful things. Thoughts should be guarded as carefully as deeds, for thought is actually creative and impresses an image on the surrounding atmosphere of which a permanent record remains. Some men are haunted when they come over here by what they have themselves unwittingly created. Of course, on Earth thought is creative also, for everything has that to be planned or arranged in someone's mind before it is made by hands or machinery. In the spirit world, too, we can speak by thought, by telepathy. That is how we overcome the difficulty of different languages. This does not mean that I have no privacy of thought, and that my mind is open for all to read. I have to project a thought when I want to communicate it, just as all a hypnotist's thoughts are not conveyed to his patient, but only those which he directly impresses. If you could get people attuned properly, they could even think music at each other. All wrong thought goes to build up and strengthen the power of evil, called by men the devil. In the beginning, I am told, it was almost negative. Man increased it himself by inflicting pain, by cruelty, by lust and envy. There is great spiritual and mental unrest among men now and has been for some time past, however undefined, obscure, and misunderstood, because man is evolving and there is an unconscious struggle between the spiritual and animal in him. Chaos and disturbance are the result. As to the people whose faith you say is shaken by the war, all I can say is, it's not much of a faith. They are trying to limit God again. He does not work for one country, but for the good of all mankind, and each nation will learn what it requires for its future development. It would be as sensible for a doctor to treat one symptom of disease in the body only, instead of strengthening and cleansing the whole of it. The systems of the world are being purified. In the past we have put aside or trifled with things that now must be faced in earnest. The earth plane is God's garden, and it was a beautiful garden. What is left of God in it is still beautiful, but it is now full of weeds of evil, disease, poverty, and selfishness. The gardeners are beginning to realize that further trimming is of no use, and these things must be uprooted utterly. In the past so many enjoyed the sunshine and fruit and flowers, and neglected the weeds, which were brushed aside and hidden as unlovely and troublesome things. They have now become rampant, and only drastic measures are any use. I know sometimes things look depressing, but I solemnly promise you there is a silver lining to this dark cloud. Men in the old days worked for individual progress. In future the ideal will be to work for others, for the good of the whole and the improvement of the community. I am told the sacrifices of this war have not been in vain, that a purified England will result. There will be a spiritual revolution. People will try to face truth, to drop some of the shams that are now used to veil it. Perhaps present events do seem to you like a dark tunnel, but I see the sun shining at the end of it, and I know there has never been a crisis in the world's history which has held so much certainty of ultimate good arising out of it. Nations and peoples, like individuals, sooner or later reap what they themselves have sown of good and evil, and knowing this, one realizes that no life, nor the life of any nation, is a succession of disconnected events. There is a sequence running through them all. They fit into each other like the pieces of a puzzle, though one only sees it clearly as a whole when life on earth is over and the last piece has fitted into its place. 2. Claude's letter is a letter written when Claude was in the ranks. August 1914, my darling mother, I hope you arrived home safely last night. On my way back after leaving you, I overtook a lance corporal in the engineers coming in my direction, so we walked along together. We became quite pals. He took me into his tent, one of those situated below the gymnasium, and showed me several dodges in using the rifle. After that we sat and yarned till just before 10, when I turned in. The daring sergeant's sources were not in good form last night. The threat of having up the offenders before the major appears to have had the desired effect. The corporal with whom I was yarning had three brothers in the Zulu and Boer wars, so that his stories were extremely interesting. Parade this morning commenced at 6.15 and breakfast at 7.30. At the 9 o'clock parade about a dozen of us were picked out, including myself and I, to form what might be termed a super recruit squad, as we are more advanced than the others. We are to be rushed on and drafted to our companies this week, if possible. The selected few are drilled by one Sergeant K, the humorous character with the crisp repartee. During the 10 to 11 interval, L, and I sat in the shade of the canteen with Sergeants K, and B, and another sergeant, whose lack of military knowledge is only surpassed by the superabundance of flesh round his plimsoll line. By dint of a half pint of beer all round and a winning smile, I soon got on excellent terms with the lot, and was rewarded with some shockingly humorous anecdotes from Sergeant K. In the Zulu campaign his experiences were positively side-splitting, especially as he sees the funny side of everything. The story of one of his friends, who was shot on his bare back by a Zulu whose blunderbuss was loaded with chopped-up telephone wires, and leapt into the trenches with a yell, with his back bristling with copper spikes, takes a lot of beating. The cream of the joke was that the miserable victim had to spend the rest of his military career in explaining to willfully incredulous but secretly delighted inquirers how he came to be shot in the back if he wasn't running away. Needless to say, the more indignantly he denied the soft impeachment, the more skeptical his tormentors became. Scarcely less funny are his experiences when serving with the British expedition to quell the riots in Crete. I nearly put my foot in it today. After 12 o'clock I went to read the paper on the hill overlooking the sea near the fort entrance, and fell asleep. L left me to go to dinner. I slumbered peacefully on. Our next parade was at 2, but at 5 minutes past I was still dreaming, until the breathless L dashed up to say that drill had started 10 minutes before. However, Sergeant K, seeing us coming in the dim distance, relapsed into a spasm of deep thought, with his back to the squad, and consequently pretended not to notice our arrival. But I nearly had a spasm over it. I am going down to the ship tonight and I shall be very glad to get some grub, as I've had nothing for dinner but sleep, which isn't very filling. I have fallen on hard times. I have a cold in my right eye, a pain in my left arm, due, of course, to the vaccination, and a bit of a headache, due, I expect, to the same cause. However, I am getting used to the floor of the gymnasium, as I heard it called this morning. I will write again soon. Your loving son, Claude. The following letters were written from the front after Claude joined the Royal Flying Corps. France, my darling mother, thank you so much for your letters and the cakes. I believe, as a matter of fact, that a postal transport was lost, stolen, or strayed recently, as no one got any letters for a day or two. I had a 2-hour trip yesterday on wireless work, overpays as usual, But owing to a clear sky and an erratic course, Archie didn't risk straining his neck over us. After tea, I had one of the most miraculous escapes on record in the Flying Corps. It happened thuswise: I was taking up an FE, our largest fighting pusher biplane in the service, for the first time. H, being very anxious to accompany me to save ballast, as he put it, came too. Everything went well getting off, and I was beginning to congratulate myself when the engine stopped without a second's warning. On reviewing the situation, the prospects were hardly promising. We were 60 feet up, and over an impermeable square of 50-foot trees, and too low to turn, not to mention it was a strange machine. Rather awkward, wasn't it? However, I kept straight on for the trees in front, gliding as flat as I dared, hoping to clear the top and reach a plowed field beyond. Nothing doing. Note: Providence had ordained that two trees should be cut down, and those two left a gap the exact width of my machine, though it looked smaller. Trying to get over them, I got too flat, and losing flying speed stalled the machine. As an ASC mechanic told me afterwards, she got through that gap with just a 2-inch clearance on both sides. No sooner had she passed, than down went her nose almost vertically for earth, and about 40 feet up. There was nothing for it but to hold the stick hard back and wait for her to pick up enough speed to answer the elevator. Rather unpleasant, that wait. 13 feet off the plow, she started pulling up, and instead of striking the ground vertically, she struck it at 45 superscript O. By all the laws of nature, she ought to have turned over and deposited her engine through yours truly and H, and made a hole in the ground. But no, we weren't for it this time. She struck a bit sideways at 50 miles an hour and 450 down, spun round, smashed to smithereens, top to bottom. H, and I got out without a scratch. But, facing the gap in the trees, how, I dunno. The getting out, consisting of placing one foot straight on the ground, which in view of the fact that ordinarily the cockpit is 11 feet up and has to be reached by a step ladder, is no mean symptom of the condition of the machine. We both got out, shook hands spontaneously, and laughed. It really was rather funny. But our adventures were not at an end. Within 3 minutes of crashing, a rapidly increasing whistle changed to a moan and finished up with a bang. On first thoughts, I thought we were being shelled, as the explosive pitched 300 yards off, though in view of our distance from the lines it was highly improbable. However, a more distinct and regular drone betrayed a Hun machine, about 7,000 feet up, and apparently vertically above. The advent of another whistle, precisely like the first, made the crowd that had collected disperse with considerably greater alacrity than one is accustomed to see in Belgian peasantry. The second one was a darned good shot considering his height, as it fell within 200 yards of us, and blew a hole in the ground. He then went on his way rejoicing, and gave Abe another, though with what result I have not hitherto ascertained. I have secured half a dozen portions of his second shot at us, as mementos of the occasion. The local damage was considerable. 7 potatoes were irretrievably damaged. One in particular was riddled with shrapnel and quite inedible. So my first real crash has been a good one. I have taken a couple of snaps of it. I hope they will turn out satisfactory. I have also got the canvas off my QC tail, with sundry patches, most of them acquired in our scrap over Lille. Think we shall have to start a museum after the war. By the way, it was lucky I did not fly over, as Captain C flew over last Friday, the day before I came out, and spent half an hour in the channel with a dud engine, and was salved by a destroyer. Rather nasty if there had been two of us on board the machine. Well, it's about time I did some work. 11 a.m. I must go and test my QC if it has been finished. Goodbye for the present. Tons of love to all. Your loving son, Claude France. My darling mother, another dud day, but by no means a wasted one. After breakfast, 4 of us started off on foot for a trudge to the trenches, though we got a lift right up to Hayes. The town is in a most extraordinary state, just as though a stupendous earthquake had paid it a visit, and is so deserted that it is veritably a city of the dead. The remains of the far-famed cloth hall and cathedral have still traces of their old beauty, with here and there traces of frescoes and carvings. The cemetery has been shelled beyond recognition, and the gasometer is by no means gas tight. We went southwards by the Lille Gate and visited a battery dugout near X, where we refreshed the inner man. Thence we entered the first communicating trench, quite half a mile long, and worked up into the reserve trenches towards Sanctuary Wood and Maple Copse. Most extraordinary the way the trenches run, each with its name on a post at the ends. Lover's Walk, Bond Street, Suicide Corner were a few I noticed in passing. The ground around was a mass of shell holes, graves, and fallen trees. The air was none too pure either, as the recent attacks have kept the men too busy to dispose of all the poor devils who were knocked out. In the wood itself, one can walk about in comparative safety, though 70 or 80% of the trees have been lopped off at the base by passing shells. The German trench mortars were pretty active and making lots of noise, whilst every now and then, about 7 or 8 times a minute, one could hear the crack of a rifle, as one or other of our snipers spotted a target, and quite as frequently as if, as the Germans did the same, and the bullets came over the trench we were in. They make a noise almost like a sigh, but are not nearly so unpleasant to my mind as the shells one can hear coming for 10 or 15 seconds with a noise like a heavy goods train, finishing up with a crash that makes one jump like a shot rabbit. Eventually we found ourselves in the front line trenches and within 20 yards of the Germans. Looking through a periscope they only appeared about 5, with stacks of barbed wire and men who had fallen in the last attack in between. Indeed, in some places, where a trench had been only partially taken or lost by one side or the other, they were actually in the same trench, with a dozen or so coils of barbed wire as a partition, 5 yards distance between their barricade and ours. Coming away they sniped at us, but with no success, and we got within 20 yards of one of our machines brought down last month, and within 30 of the remains of the 1H, strafed on one of his many duels. 3 o'clock found us on our way back, and, within an hour we were having tea in an artillery dugout. Thence we skirted trees, and by walking along the remains of the railway line struck the main road homeward bound. Walking along the line we were surprised to hear a hidden voice yelling at us to clear out, which we didn't take long to do, as I spotted the muzzle of a 6-inch gun within 20 feet of us loaded and cocked and pointing our way, but it was so well hidden that we hadn't noticed it till the gunner yelled out. Anyway, it went off within 30 seconds with a pretty resounding bang. That's one of the beauties of life out here, you never know what's going to happen next. In passing all that is left of Hayes Station we gave a peep in at the running sheds. One of the only 2 engines inside was a rickety and prehistoric old pram, and the other had had its chimney taken off as clean as a whistle by the shell that had plonked a neat hole in the wall, and was too knocked about to ever be serviceable again. 50 yards down the line was another loco, with a shell hole plonked through the boiler, with tubes sticking out all over like a hedgehog. Another 100 yards and there were the 2 largest shell holes I've ever seen, and there are some sizey ones in Hayes. 2 pits about 25 feet deep and the bottom full of water with a circumference of at least 30 feet. When one sees that the edges of the holes are about 10 feet apart in the Jack Johnsons, cannot have been fired at a range of less than 15 miles, one cannot but respect the German artillery. Besides, they were both beautifully placed in the middle of the station sidings, with rails lying about torn and twisted like so much cotton. The town walls show innumerable scars in every direction, and the whole presents a picture one can never forget. The trenches we had visited were at the very apex of the Hayes salient, surrounded by Teutons on 3 sides, though the Highlanders who were in them were as cheery as larks. A few hunks of shell accompanied me home as souvenirs. Time I knocked off now, post orderly's just going. Love to all. Your loving son, Claude, my darling mother, just a line to let you know that I am in excellent form, though very hard worked. Having done 11 1/4 hours in 4 days, which is rather stiff considering the heights vary from 6,000 feet upward, and Archie has been increasingly active and accurate. However, I think things will cool off again by the end of next week, which is comforting. Moreover, the prospect of a week's leave is distinctly cheering, and it may come in 3, or 4, or 10, or 11 days, or later, according to circumstances. We are rather a sad little party just now, as B Flight Commander and an observer, both awfully good fellows, fell victims to Archie the day before yesterday. However, H promptly went up and did in one of their scouts in return, so things are almost square again. The weather has cleared up beautifully, and shows symptoms of starting another summer. I saw England yesterday for the first time from here. The brilliant white cliffs lining a sea of the deepest blue, whilst the entire world lay under an ocean of mist, tinged pink with the rising sun, was a sight that it is not easy to forget. One does see most wonderfully beautiful sights flying high at dawn. The shadow of the machine follows one along the clouds below, surrounded by a white halo, which in turn is encircled by a complete little rainbow. And just as one is beginning to be sentimental, bang, goes an Archie with a yellow flame and a puff of smoke, and makes you jump like a jack in the box and dodge like a squib, and one's mind returns to the job in hand with a jerk. Trying to take photographs yesterday, I dived through a valley in the clouds down to 6,000 feet, but before I got over the target off went for well-placed 4-inch high explosives, and I was back in the clouds before you could say snap. However, the Germans are nothing if not methodical, and they tried to pepper the entire cloud. Rather amusing. We have a new and swollen-headed youth here, who can't have been properly brought up, who is training as an observer, and who is very given to criticizing pilots and their flying. He was rash enough to tell me that he didn't think I had had long enough in the air to be safe, and other offensive remarks of a like nature. Well, having finished a job of work, as wireless duty is called, I brought him back to the aerodrome, with the fixed determination to give him a lesson, so I tail-slid him, and side-slipped, and nose-dived, and stalled, and pitched, and rolled. Towards the end of 5 minutes he looked round very sheepishly, and said he'd be ill in a minute. Naturally I sympathized deeply, and gave two colossal tosses. He was wrong, he didn't hold out for nearly a minute, and I must confess I was cruel enough to slow up the machine in order that he could hear me chuckling. I haven't heard him criticize my flying since. Alas for him, he had me as a pilot again today, and I brought him over the aerodrome at much the same height. However, as he had made so much fuss about the previous performance, I brought him down sarcastically, that is to say, so slowly that he might have been a rich and elderly relation. But all to no purpose. He had already been ill at the prospect of what he thought he'd have to go through. Dear, dear, it's a hard world, but it's a bilious air. Goodbye for the present, fondest love to all. Your loving son, Claude, France. My darling mother, it must seem quite an age since I last wrote to you. We have had quite a gay time for the last 3 days, though very little in the flying line. On Monday, the weather being pleasantly unpleasant, we dunked in the afternoon, lunched there and did some shopping, but returned almost immediately, as the roads were so bad that we didn't like to face them in the dark. Tuesday proved a very rough morning, but after tea 4 of us went into the little town of X, 4 miles from here, to a cinema. The show is run by the 6th Corps, and entertains 200 or 300 men every night. Fancy an army carrying a cinematograph with it. Unfortunately, we got back too late for the post. Next morning the news leaked out that the King was going to inspect us. About 6,000 infantry were paraded on the aerodrome, and a flagstaff erected in the center. The Flying Corps were well represented. I had had instructions to fly up and around, to give the show a finishing touch, but a darn thunderstorm came up and provided that instead. The King arrived at 10:30, and the men marched past in great style. Unfortunately, the rain prevented the royal party, including the Prince of Wales, and accompanied by Sir John French, from coming round the sheds afterwards, though a number of the staff, commonly called tin hats, had to be shown round. Two buttonholed me, and, there being no means of an honourable retreat, I did the showman act for half an hour. In the evening the entire flight, with two exceptions, motored into X, to see a Pierrot Chauve, run by 5 officers and 2 Belgian girls, who are let off for the purpose of entertaining the men. Darned good show, too. Anything that makes one forget the war for a couple of hours is very welcome. I ran across a chap I knew at Eastbourne at the Fancies, as they style themselves. I believe he and I used to have hotly contested competitions for the bottom seat in class.